The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And at first, I'm going to conclude the special issue about breast cancer. And we were talking about various kinds of surgical options for treating of breast cancer. And the first thing we talked about was breast-conserving surgery or lumpectomy and the advantages of this procedure. And it concludes that research is showing that people with small, less aggressive cancers may be able to sidestep post-surgery radiation without risking without raising the risk of cancer recurrence. Then there's the procedure mastectomy. In this procedure, surgeons remove one or both breasts while you're under general anesthesia. This is now often done as an outpatient procedure. Mastectomy is more involved than lumpectomy and requires a longer recovery. If undergoing mastectomy, you may choose to have surgery to restore breast shape. This procedure is called breast reconstruction. Ideally, reconstruction can be done at the same time as mastectomy, or it may be a second surgery later. While mastectomy has historically involved removing the nipple and the areola, now the nipple and areola may be preserved in some people having a mastectomy, depending on the size and location of the cancer. In recent years, robotics and other advances also have enabled surgeons to use smaller incisions. In addition to all the advances in breast surgery, there have been dramatic changes in the management of the lymph nodes under the arm. Rather than removing all the lymph nodes from the armpit, surgeons more commonly remove only the first few lymph nodes to which cancer usually spreads. These are the sentinel nodes. This change greatly reduces the risk of post-surgical arm swelling, called lymphedema. Whether you opt for lumpectomy or a mastectomy, depends more on your cancer's size, location, and biology. It also depends on your preferences. When a woman asks me what I recommend, I explain that I need to get to know her preferences, and what she's worried about. Says Dr. Bowie, once I have that information, we talk through the options and together make a decision that's best for her. For example, some women prefer breast-conserving surgery because they worry that after a mastectomy, they would feel uncomfortable in locker rooms, the shower, the bedroom, or other situations. Other women feel that a mastectomy would give them more peace of mind. In addition, no breast imaging is needed after a double mastectomy. Some women prefer this. No one can make these important personal decisions for you. However, your care team can help you consider how each option might affect your life in the short and long term. When deciding on a treatment plan, consider how you'll likely feel about your choice 10 or 15 years from now, says Dr. Bowie. How will it likely affect you physically, emotionally, socially, romantically? The chart above can help you weigh the pros and cons. And the chart is a list of the pros and cons of breast-conserving surgery called lumpectomy versus mastectomy. And it explains that lumpectomy, the breast-conserving surgery, is best for small, single cancerous masses and average or large breasts. It points out that it can often preserve the original appearance of the breast, but it may change the shape of the breast, and regular follow-up breast imaging is needed for both breasts. Follow-up radiation is also usually needed. Then there's mastectomy, in other words, removal of the entire breast. And the advantage of this is that there's no follow-up breast imaging needed. And all breast tissue is removed. However, recovery takes several weeks. And mastectomy is usually recommended for large cancerous masses or multiple breast masses. The science of breast cancer continues to change. New screening options, medications, and surgical techniques are continually being explored. For example, since 2023, the Food and Drug Administration has approved 4 new breast cancer-fighting medications and expanded the use of 2 others. We keep getting advances in systemic therapy options and radiation, and even whole new categories of treatment, says Dr. Giridhar. These advances do much more than improve survival. They also provide more choices, allowing you to match your care to your needs and goals. And then there's a couple of useful small articles that are attached to this longer piece. And the first is a short discussion of the question, do I still need to do breast self-exams? And the answer is, most medical experts no longer recommend routine breast self-exams as a part of breast cancer screening. That's because breast self-exams haven't been shown to be effective and reducing deaths from breast cancer. Still, healthcare professionals believe there is value in being familiar with your breasts. If you feel or see anything that seems unusual, even if you've recently had a mammogram, mention it to your healthcare team. You know your body better than anyone, says Dr. Fraker. Don't be afraid to get things checked out. This is especially important if you've previously had breast cancer. Except for breast imaging, breast care experts do not recommend routine full-body scans, like a CT scan, to check for signs that cancer has returned. Instead, your healthcare team will meet with you to monitor your health. Between these visits, watch for symptoms on your own. Call your care team to schedule an evaluation if you notice any unusual symptoms. And the unusual symptoms that you would be looking for. If you've had a lumpectomy, you should call your healthcare team if you notice a new lump or a regular area of firmness in your breast, underarm, collarbone, or neck, changes to the skin of the breast, skin inflammation or an area of redness, nipple discharge, change or inversion, or changes to the shape or contour of the breast. If you've had a mastectomy, in other words, removal of the entire breast, you should contact your healthcare team if one or more painless nodules develop on or under the skin of your chest wall, reconstructed breast, underarm, collarbone, or neck. Or if a new area of thickening occurs along or near the mastectomy scar, or if there is changes to skin on your chest. Another useful article. I've heard that hormone therapy can increase my risk of breast cancer. How do I weigh that risk against the benefits? Whether taken by mouth or through the skin, Menopausal hormone therapy contains hormones that replace some of the hormones lost after menopause. It's true that some forms of hormone therapy can slightly increase the risk of developing breast cancer, especially in people who already are considered high risk. That's because the hormones, estrogen and progesterone, can fuel the growth of some breast cancers. However, this doesn't necessarily mean you must forego hormone therapy, especially if menopause symptoms like hot flashes and night sweats are interfering with your quality of life. Ask your care team to help you weigh your individual risks and benefits. Most women with a history of breast cancer are not candidates for hormone therapy. In addition, hormone therapy isn't recommended for women who have a history of blood clots in the veins. Those who smoke or have unmanaged high blood pressure should proceed with caution. Now I'm going to continue with the Mayo Clinic health letter. And I'm going to start with a couple of useful questions entitled Second Opinion. Question. I've heard that physical exertion in cold weather can cause heart problems, but I can't convince my husband to let someone else shovel snow for us. Can you please help? You're correct. Heart events like heart attacks happen more often in cold temperatures, especially when people have existing heart problems and try to exercise in frosty conditions. In 2023, a major international study found that extreme heat and extreme cold both elevate the risk of death from heart disease, with cold being significantly riskier than heat. When you're outside in the cold, your nervous system adapts to conserve heat while still supplying blood and oxygen to vital organs and muscles. To do this, blood vessels narrow, a process called vasoconstriction. This narrowing causes pressure to build throughout the body's circulatory system. It puts stress on the heart, which must work harder to pump the same amount of blood. Exercise causes additional stress on the heart, which in most cases is healthy and encouraged, but it can quickly turn dangerous given the layers of stress you experience in cold weather, especially if you have heart disease or related conditions. Blood sometimes responds to cold by getting slightly thicker and more likely to clot, and clotting is related to emergency events like heart attack and stroke. If you have a heart condition, consult your healthcare team about whether outdoor exertion is okay in winter. You may want to propose a compromise where your husband keeps doing warm weather tasks like cutting grass and raking in exchange for letting someone else handle winter chores. Here are some other tips to stay safe in winter. Pace yourself. Set a repeating timer for 10 minutes or less so you have reminder to take breaks. Warm yourself and allow your heart rate to return to its resting state. Stay hydrated. Drinking water or electrolyte drinks before, during, and after your shoveling session. Start early in a snowfall. Freshly fallen snow is lighter than snow that has started melting or has been moved by a plow. And buddy up. Make sure someone else knows you're outside and will check in regularly. Have your smartphone fully charged to use in case of an emergency. And then there's another question, again on the Mayo Clinic health letter. And that question is, many people I know say that physical therapy doesn't work, but when I ask if they continue to do exercises at home, they usually say no. Any ideas about helping them stick to a PT program for the long haul? Your experience is common. At-home exercise is a component of treatment plans for a variety of conditions, like low back pain, joint replacement, and cancer. The regimen may be for weeks, months, or years, and requires daily practice. Surveys have found that 70% of people given an at-home exercise program by a medical professional do not fully follow it. Sticking to a rehab plan reduces the risk of the original condition returning. It also can guard against complications like balance and weight concerns. Physical therapists are working to address the challenge of maintaining motivation for the entire length of a rehabilitation plan. Every situation is different, but some common themes apply. It's important to approach a home exercise program like any new habit, says Pamela Klein, a physical therapist at Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona. Practice it every day and see the rewards of your commitment. To get the most out of rehabilitation, devote part of your daily schedule to exercises. If you are not in the habit of regular exercise, or if you have fatigue or a mood disorder, you may have more difficulty sticking to a routine. If so, ask for support. Sometimes a routine may seem too complicated and time-consuming. If so, work with your healthcare team to prioritize the aspects of your plan that will make the biggest impact. Dr. Klein suggests asking which two or three at-home exercises are most important and then focusing on completing those regularly. Add more exercises as you develop the habit and get stronger. Regular check-ins with your care team can help you stay on track. You may want to suggest changes like more frequent meetings if this would help you. Ask about virtual visits. Other options might include having regular check-ins on your health portal or using a smartphone app. Enlisting supportive family or friends can help with encouragement and motivation. Now, here's an important discussion in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of February 2025 entitled Chocolate, Pros and Cons for Your Health. On an island just off the coast of Panama lives an indigenous tribe called the Kuna, who outlive other people in Panama. Despite their relatively high salt diet, the Kuna, that's K-U-N-A, tend to have lower blood pressure than do other people in Panama. In addition, they experience fewer heart attacks, and they're less likely to be diagnosed with type 2 diabetes or cancer. For several decades, researchers have traveled to this area searching for the Kuna tribe's secret to good health. After much study, these scientists determined that what set the Kuna people apart wasn't what they ate. It likely stemmed from what they drank, more than 5 cups of cocoa daily. Since these scientists stumbled upon this connection, they've been trying to figure out whether the consumption of cocoa and the chocolate made from it benefits overall health. It's thought that cocoa may benefit health for two reasons. First, it's rich in flavanols, antioxidants believed to protect blood vessels from aging. Secondly, it contains theobromine, a bitter-tasting stimulant that may reduce inflammation. People often use the words cacao, cocoa, and chocolate interchangeably, but they mean slightly different things. To make cocoa, manufacturers dry, roast, and pulverize the beans from the cacao tree. Pure cocoa is very bitter. To mask its bitter flavor, manufacturers add sugar, milk, and fat to create commercially available hot cocoa mixes and chocolate bars. The research on chocolate and its health benefits has been mixed. One study that followed the eating habits of 55,000 people determined that the rates of atrial fibrillation, an irregular heart rhythm, were lower in people who consumed chocolate more often. Another large long-term study hinted that chocolate consumption might reduce the risk of having a heart attack. But those observational studies only showed a correlation between chocolate consumption and health. They don't prove cause and effect. Randomized controlled trials are best for that. The cocoa supplement and multivitamin outcomes study, called COSMOS, is one of the largest and longest-running randomized controlled trials to look at the relationship between chocolate consumption and health. In this trial, some of the over 21,000 participants consumed a supplement twice a day that contained 500 milligrams of cocoa flavanols. Other participants took placebo. During the study, participants who consumed the cocoa supplement experienced similar rates of heart attacks as did participants who took placebo pills. They also had similar rates of type 2 diabetes and performed similarly on tests of cognitive health. But the study participants who consumed the cocoa supplements were 27% less likely to die of heart-related events. In a separate review of 35 randomized controlled trials involving more than 1,800 people, the consumption of flavanol-enriched cocoa led to a small 2 millimeter of mercury drop in blood pressure over 9 weeks. The potential health benefits of chocolate are likely mild at best. In addition, they're difficult to attain by consuming store-bought chocolate. That's because the cocoa used in research differs significantly from chocolate sold commercially. For example, the cocoa supplement in the COSMOS study contained 500 milligrams of flavanols. That's five times more flavanol than most people consume daily from all flavanol-rich foods and beverages, including teas, berries, and grapes. In store-bought chocolate, the addition of other ingredients, especially sugar and saturated fat, dramatically dilutes the cocoa content. This reduces the amount of flavanols. If you don't like chocolate, there's no compelling reason to force yourself to eat it. However, if you love this sweet treat, use the following advice. First of all, you should go dark. The darker the chocolate, the less sugar and more cocoa and flavanols the chocolate contains. Despite its name, white chocolate contains no cocoa at all. Look for products that list the percentage of cocoa. The higher the percent listed, the more flavanols and less sugar. Similarly, if you drink hot chocolate, make it from unsweetened 100% cocoa. Keep portions in check. Keep in mind that even the darkest bars of chocolate still contain a lot of calories and sugar. For example, one large 101 gram, 70% to 85% cacao bar of chocolate comes with 604 calories, 43 grams of fat, and 24 grams of sugar. So you should keep portions small and think of chocolate as an occasional treat. Yes, chocolate is likely better for your health than other types of candy, but it's no substitute for minimally processed foods like legumes, nuts, seeds, eggs, poultry, and fish. In addition to cocoa, black and green tea, cinnamon, grapes, and apples come packed with flavonoids. Many different plant foods, including most fruits, vegetables, and herbs contain numerous other health-promoting substances. So rather than zeroing in on only chocolate, try to eat a wide variety of plant foods. And then, just briefly, there's a section entitled Beating Bad Breath. Halitosis can be a symptom of a minor or sometimes serious health concerns. The most common cause is odor-producing bacteria trapped in the tongue or on the teeth or dentures. Other sources include tooth decay, faulty fillings, and gum disease. Also, gastroesophageal reflux disease and diabetes can contribute to breath odor. And things that you might want to think about doing include floss daily, brush your tongue, drink water because saliva has antiseptic properties, chew gum to stimulate saliva production. Also, you should avoid things like onions, garlic, coffee, alcohol, and tobacco. And you should schedule dental checkups twice a year. Your dental team can check you for potential issues and provide a good cleaning at the same time. If the issue persists, consult your dentist or primary health care team to determine if underlying health conditions are at play. And those health conditions might include, as mentioned previously, gastroesophageal reflux or diabetes. Well, it looks like we're out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.